Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, it's a conversation with Valerie Biden Owens, President Biden's sister. Her new memoir is called Growing Up Biden. And Philadelphia Inquirer sports writer Marcus Hayes joins us to talk Philly sports. But we begin today's show with a look at the local impact of the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe versus Wade. For the moment, abortion access will not change in New Jersey, Delaware, or Pennsylvania. In New Jersey, the right to an abortion was enshrined in state law earlier this year as legislators and Governor Murphy anticipated the Supreme Court's decision. Delaware has also codified abortion access into law. In Pennsylvania, abortion laws remain in place, but Pennsylvania's legislature is Republican majority. Some lawmakers have introduced legislation to restrict abortion further, and a new governor will take office next January. Sam Dunklaw is Capitol Bureau Chief for WITF, and he is here with us now. Welcome back, Sam.
Good to be back, Mary.
So to start, characterize abortion access in Pennsylvania under current state law. What does it look like?
So pregnant women here are able to access the procedure generally unfettered up to 24 weeks of pregnancy. So that's the end of the second trimester. There are some rules as far as that goes. Women have to consult with a doctor at least 24 hours beforehand. Minors have to obtain their parents' permission. And the standard health insurance that is offered on the state's marketplace will cover the procedure, but it has to be under certain conditions. The pregnancy had to have resulted from rape or incest, or the life of the mother has to be in danger. And folks can get abortions after 24 weeks, but again, they have to, one of those three conditions has to be met in order for it to be covered. That's a compromise that was reached several decades ago here in the Keystone State. Mm-hmm. And it's remained in place because there has been no challenge to Roe versus Wade, which sort of underpinned all of this, but now, of course, that's been upended.
Sam, how have elected officials in Pennsylvania reacted to the Supreme Court decision on Friday?
Well, it's broken down party lines, as you could probably expect. Yeah. Democratic state lawmakers took to Twitter, made their voices known over the weekend, sent out statements to all of us on Friday saying that they were disheartened by the ruling. House Democrats went as far as to say that the decision would harm women's access to health care. That's a line that you've heard across the spectrum as far as that goes. Senate Democrats have also said that they're worried that other rights that the Supreme Court has granted under the 14th Amendment, that's the right to due process, might also be under threat. And they didn't elaborate on that, but okay. It's, again, a point that has been made over the last couple of months, as far as that goes. Republican state lawmakers addressing abortion every so often, but the leaders at the state house here in Harrisburg are mostly celebrating the fact that the ruling delivers the question of abortion back to states. They're happy that the states now get to be the ultimate arbiter on abortion.
Democratic Governor Wolf is term limited. He cannot run for re-election. Where do the Democratic and Republican gubernatorial nominees stand on abortion access?
About as clear as you could expect, and again, breaking down party lines. Remember, this decision, a draft of this decision was leaked some months ago, so we've already had some insight into what the gubernatorial candidates have had to say on this, but they made their points known again. Democrat Josh Shapiro writing on Twitter on Friday that the decision represented a devastating day in America, and immediately painting the contrast between him and Republican candidate Doug Mastriano, saying that Mastriano would ban abortion without exception, and Mastriano has said that in televised debates over the last couple of months, and that Shapiro would work to keep abortion legal. In checking Senator Mastriano's social media feeds on the day of the decision, I didn't see anything directly addressing the Supreme Court ruling except for an infographic that said that Pennsylvanians will not be distracted by the hysterics of the left. Again, Mastriano has made his point quite clear on abortion. He, like other Republicans, believe in a right to life and that abortion should be illegal in most circumstances.
Sam, are there bills before Pennsylvania lawmakers, state lawmakers, right now, which would restrict abortion access?
Yes, there are seven. And they address it in different ways. I mean, for instance, women would not be able to get abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. That's a so-called heartbeat bill. That's one bill that's there. There are also another two that say that abortion would be illegal if a woman is seeking it as the result of a fetal Down syndrome diagnosis. There's a constitutional amendment, for instance, and I'm just reading right from the text of the constitutional amendment that says that the state constitution does not grant or secure any right relating to abortion or the public funding thereof. So the line of restriction in a lot of these bills is saying, let's restrict it further under certain circumstances, and let's try to get the public funding of abortion, that is funneling state dollars through the state health insurance marketplace, through Medicaid, to pay for the procedure. And that's been the contention that Republicans in the legislature have had with abortion for decades now. And now they have a chance to potentially address it.
The journey of a constitutional amendment is a little bit different than that of, say, a standard bill. Remind us of what needs to happen with such legislation before final approval.
Sure. So a constitutional amendment has to pass in two consecutive sessions. So every session here in Harrisburg lasts 2 years. The bill would have to pass at least once during that year, and then it would have to be reintroduced in the immediate next session, go through the whole bill debate process once again to have tweaks and amendments and so forth. And if it passes in that session, it then goes before voters on the next immediate election. There's some advertising provisions that need to happen. But essentially, one of these amendments can get on the ballot in as little as 2 years. And right now, the amendment that's before the General Assembly hasn't been passed yet this session. But if it were to be passed this session, then again, immediately in the spring or summer of next year, it could end up on the ballot as early as the spring or potentially even in the fall.
Okay. Well, as you've reported, Sam, Democrats want to see Josh Shapiro in the governor's mansion. But if this sort of legislation, if a constitutional amendment were to be passed, is this a way to get around the governor's veto pen?
It is. And we've seen this trend start to take root, especially this session, with Republican lawmakers who have been frustrated at what they say is an inability to speak with the governor's mansion on substantive policy. And, of course, the governor contends that he has not been willing to talk with Republicans on certain topics like their efforts to address voter integrity, for instance. So Republicans have attempted to introduce as many amendments as possible as an end run around the governor's veto pen, again, that they see as overly restrictive, as non-functional, more or less. So as you mentioned, Mary, if Shapiro were to win the governor's mansion, the Republicans would still have that as an option in their back pocket. And there isn't really much chance of the dynamic in Harrisburg changing too much after November.
Well, Democrats also want to see more seats, of course, come over to their side. They want to see more seats won in the state House and Senate in November. How many seats do they need to capture to make a difference when it comes to passing or blocking legislation? And what are the odds this might happen?
Most legislation can be approved on a simple majority, and most legislation that is vetoed by the governor has to be overturned on the two-thirds majority. So at minimum, Democrats that want to affect some policy change as far as this goes would have to get a simple majority. Right now in the House, there is a 111-92 split, 111 for Republicans, 92 for Democrats. In the Senate, there is a 21 Democrat to 28 Republican split with one independent. So I ran the math on this before the show. There's a chance that House Democrats could flip as many as a dozen House districts. There's a competitive enough a margin in those in the coming election. But the margins are very small, like 1 or 2% in a lot of those districts. So at minimum, Democrats need 9 seats. They could pick up as many as 12. But again, the likelihood of that, especially with all of the things that are going on right now in this election, with this being a wave, a potential wave year for Republicans, the President Joe Biden's job performance, I wouldn't hedge, or I would not advise the Democrats to hedge their bets on that. The Senate, you know, because again, the Senate is the other side of this equation. The Democrats would need to pick up 5 seats in the Senate to get a majority. And that's unlikely since in the last redistricting process, the Senate map didn't change very much.
What are you hearing? And I'm not sure if you have the information right now to answer this, but can the issue, the overturning of Roe v. Wade, spell a difference for Democrats in the midterm elections coming up?
I think that that's what they've been planning and expecting. I mean, from what I've been hearing, again, you know, because this decision leaked a couple of months ago, we saw what publicly played out between the two parties, how the two parties would react. There was some discussion at that time among Democratic strategists that this could be an issue that would motivate their voters to get to the polls. You know, again, in a Republican wave year, in a midterm election where turnout is expected to at least be lower than in the presidential years, Democrats need every voter possible to get out to the polls to vote. And even now, I mean, if you look on some of the activists that are on social media that are talking about this are saying, we won't necessarily support Democrats just because they're Democrats and they say that they are pro-choice. They need to be out in the streets with us. They need to be showing and stepping up. So there's another element to that strategy. Yes, abortion can motivate voters to get to the polls on the Democratic side. But, you know, that's not the only box that Democrats necessarily need to check in order to increase turnout.
Yeah, remains to be seen. Do we have a sense, Sam Dunklaw, as to how many abortions are performed in Pennsylvania every year and the breakout of the population seeking abortion care?
Well, there was a great story by WHYY this past week that spelled that out. 32,000 abortions performed in Pennsylvania, according to the state health department. Nearly half of those were to people who identify as white, followed closely by black patients at 44%. 11% of those performed on Hispanic patients. So you're talking about a procedure that affects, at minimum, at least with the latest data available, tens of thousands of women.
Are abortion providers in Pennsylvania expecting to see a surge in people coming from out of state to seek the procedure? And if so, do they feel they can handle the influx?
There seems to be some talk about that. Planned Parenthood had had a press conference with state reporters last week, and it had expected that about 8,500 more people could start seeking abortion coming in from Pennsylvania, from states like West Virginia and Ohio, where the procedure is expected to get more restrictive now that Roe versus Wade has been overturned. But there are other states that surround Pennsylvania that are even more open to abortion. You mentioned New Jersey at the top of the hour. Yeah. New York expected to open up access to the procedure even more. So Pennsylvania being this middle ground, the folks that are helping to administer this procedure say that there is some potential that folks could continue to come and stream in from the state, but and that they could handle that influx. But it's likely that folks would be seeking that procedure in other states where it's even more accessible.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks so much, Sam Dunklaw, for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Sam Dunklaw is Capitol Bureau Chief for WITF. Up next on the Regional Roundup, we speak with President Biden's younger sister, Valerie Biden Owens. She is author of Growing Up Biden, a memoir. That's ahead on the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to the Regional Roundup. Welcome back. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Valerie Biden Owens and her older brother Joe have shared an extraordinarily close relationship as best friends and colleagues for over 7 decades. Valerie, the only daughter of 4 children in the close-knit Biden family of Delaware. Joe Biden, of course, the 46th president of the United States. Valerie Biden Owens managed or advised his numerous campaigns for the U.S. Senate and the presidency, including the very first Senate race in which Joe Biden was just 29 years old and Valerie 26, a school teacher with little experience in politics, but with the grit to break into what was then a political boys' club. Biden Owens was on the front line as well during the dark times, serving as an interim mom to her two small nephews, Beau and Hunter, after they survived a terrible traffic accident in which Joe's first wife, Nelia, and their baby daughter, Amy, died. Valerie Biden-Owens has written a new memoir called Growing Up Biden, and she joins us now on the Regional Roundup. Welcome, and so nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Mary. I'm happy to be here. Happy Monday morning.
Happy Monday morning as well to you. But yes. Let's talk about some serious stuff, I guess, here before we talk about the memoir. I'd like to ask you, Valerie, about the overturning of Roe v. Wade and what your reaction was on Friday.
My reaction, I was not surprised, but devastated. I mean, heartbroken, because overturning Roe, I mean, jeopardizes the lives of millions of women. And we've set women's health back for 50 years. It's a travesty. I mean, it's a question of fairness, that every woman should have equal access under the law to full health care, which includes reproductive rights. And I know that my brother will do everything in his power to work to restore Roe, but that the Republicans want a nationwide ban. And what we have to do is the only way that we can fight back is to protect the rights of women is to make sure that we elect pro-choice members to the House and Senate in this midterm. And in the meantime, you know, Joe will use whatever is in his power to make sure that any woman can travel to any state for whatever reasons that she wants to, and he will protect that. And he'll also, you know, work hard and make it clear that the FDA-approved pill, mefiprocitone. I think that's a is it prizotone?
You know, I've read that word so many times, and I'm not going to. Well, I'm not going to hazard a pronunciation either.
Pill. Yeah. That we will make sure to do the best of our ability to have it accessible to as many women as possible, and he'll put the authority of the Department of Health and Human Services behind that. So. In the meantime, we've just got to get out and put boots on the ground and make sure that we get men and women who will elect the right people, put the right people in our Congress to protect the health of millions of women. It's a sad day.
Let's get into your relationship with your brother. He is 3 years older than you. You've been really close as siblings all your life. Many people don't have that with their brothers and sisters. You credit your parents for this, Valerie?
Oh yeah, I remember that when we grew up, my parents told us that we were a gift to one another, and we believed it. And when my mom, you know, we were four normal kids, you know, with squabbles and arguments like any kids do. But my mom always said that when we walked out of that door of our house, when we shut the door, she said, "Remember, you're Bidens," and not meaning that you're Bidens like your Rockefellers or your Kennedys, but you were Bidens, and that meant that we were four kids who had to have each other's back. And we stuck with each other, and that there's family and there's family and there's family. That's what we were raised to. That was there are three stools and legs of the stool. There's family, faith, and responsibility, and that's what we were raised to believe. And as I said, we took it hook, line, and sinker. We believed it completely.
Yeah. You were just 26 years old when you managed your brother's campaign on his first run for the U.S. Senate in 1972. And Valerie, this was a time when women didn't do that job. Manning the phones was considered to be more appropriate. What was that experience like for you?
Well, it was a lot easier for me than it was for many women, I presume, because look, from the time that I was a little girl, I remember my brother grabbing my hand and saying, "Come on, Val, We have things to do and places to go and people to see. And he took me with him wherever he went. And when his friend said, why did you bring a girl? His answer was, she's not a girl, she's my sister. and he told me that whatever he could do, and I promise this is not an exaggeration, he said whatever he could do, he said, Val, you can do it better. He said, you're smarter than I, you're braver than I, you're kinder than I, which was impossible. He was 3 years older. But he made me believe, because he had such trust in me, and he made me want to believe that I could be that little girl or that big girl that he, you know, that he said I could be. So it was a natural that I be his campaign manager, not because I had a PhD in politics, which I didn't, but I had a PhD in my brother. I mean, we could complete each other's sentences. And
but you,
we had.
Oh, I was going to say, you do right, though, Valerie. Sometimes you had to set the guy straight.
Well, I mean, every sister has to set a brother straight. I mean, sometimes.
I meant the guys who you're working with on the political campaign or just kind of getting in there as a woman, a young woman back in 1972.
Yeah, they, you know, what my brother did was, the reason I say I had it a little easier than a lot of women, because my brother pulled up a chair at the table and said, this is my sister. She speaks for me. Whatever she says, assume I said it, and then he could go out and campaign. But once he went out of the room, the guys looked at me, and I mean, many of them considered me as a token, either as a token woman or as a token relative. And, you know, I had to, I had to stand up and say, this is the, you know, there's a couple stories in the book about the media consultant who would not believe me that I wouldn't run a negative ad and called my brother at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, when my brother said, what's the matter? And are my parents all right? Are the kids okay? And he said, no, it's your sister's the problem. And we need this ad. We have to run it. We think if you don't run it, you'll lose the election. And we ran it by your sister. And she said, no, we want to run it by you. And my brother said, well, if you ran it by my sister, and she said, no, don't bother reading it to me. And he hung up. And then the guys got, you know, some of them, it took a little bit longer to get the message. But my brother was there supporting me all the way, and most of the time, it was great. I mean, I had a strong father and three strong brothers, and I was used to dealing with men with as much respect as they gave me. I also gave them.
Shortly after Joe Biden's election to his first Senate term, there was an almost unfathomable tragedy: Nelia and Amy. His first wife and his baby daughter died in a terrible traffic accident. Valerie, you wrote that he suffered from a rage that was incandescent and horrible, and you could tell he was nearly breaking under its weight. How did you support your brother at this time, and how did he, I mean, his swearing-in happened in the hospital where his two boys were. How did he decide to go on and handle a job immediately after this terrible thing happened?
Well, my brother has always had a sense of purpose. And after the terrible accident, his purpose was that he had, as much as he didn't want to, I mean, he had to get up in the morning because he had to make things right for Beau and Hunt, who were at that time were 2 and 3 years old. So he had the children. And he had said shortly after the accident to my brother, Jimmy Biden, he said, call the governor and tell the governor that I won't be accepting this post because Delaware can get another senator, but the boys can't get another father. And we thought about it, and I remember talking to him, as my brother did too. I said, look, Joe, Nelia has worked the same problems that affected us in November 7th, when you were elected, that the people elected you to help solve, they're the same problems that are existing today on December 20th. So I think, you know, perhaps we owe it to the people of Delaware, and Nelia worked so hard to get you here, and why don't you just give it a try? And he said, how can we make it work? I said, easy, I'll move in, and I'll stay with the boys and you, and I'll stay until it's time to go. And he just nodded his head. And we had mom, dad, we had my brothers. We had a group of friends who were wonderful to us. And we took it one step at a time. And, you know, Joe got up and kept going. It bent him, but it didn't break him.
Valerie, you write in your memoir, you had never before been so horribly angry at God. You are a person of faith. Some might be uncomfortable to hear that, but how do you view that anger?
Well, I thought, you know what, I think it's natural. The hardest thing for me as a practicing Catholic is to still say the words, "Thy will be done." I don't want "Thy will be done." I want "My will to be done." there's a quote by Kierkegaard that says, "Faith sees best in the dark." And I was so angry. And people of goodwill would come up and say, you know, "It's okay, it's God's will." And I would say, "It is not God's will to have this happen. This is not God's will." And I prayed, and I take solace in, I'm not pious, but I think it's more spiritual, and I found solace in the rosary. I felt like I had to, the tight grip that I had, like, I want it this way. The more I held on, the more I realized that I had to open up and let go and say, okay, listen to my dad. No matter how many times you get knocked down, doesn't matter. It matters how quickly you get up. Adversity in every life builds character more than the spoils of victory. So get up, brush off, keep moving, and move forward. And that's what we did.
So
as a family,
when Joe Biden assumed his seat in the U.S. Senate, his fellow senators rallied around him, keeping him engaged in his work. As you tell us in the book, there was much more collegiality in those days than there is now. The rancor and bile that characterized the Senate now was unknown. Do you and your brother talk about this? And if so, have you come to any conclusion about what might make things better?
Well, we have certainly talked about the goodness and the grandness of his colleagues, you know, in the Senate, Senator Humphrey particularly, and Senators Kennedy, Mansfield, said, "Come down and try it and work with us." And all of them had a when you know each other person, when you come to know a person, not as a politician, but as an individual man or woman, it's a lot more difficult to castigate them and to say, "You're no good because you don't think the way that I do." Now the teams, the Democrats and the Republicans, are much more separated because there's not as much congeniality. They don't learn to they don't socialize together. They don't sit down, and it used to be the old Senate dining room where the Democrats and Republicans, whoever sat at the table, the next guy would sit down and say, "How's it going?" And they would discuss each other. They would have different opinions, but there was a respect that, maybe I never thought of it that way. And now everybody, my brother and I quote my parents a lot, but one of my mother's best expressions was, "Beware the righteous." And we've become so righteous on both the right and the left. Mm. You know, there is something to say, "I don't agree with you, but tell me why." I mean, compromise now has become a dirty word. I don't know how people stay married. I mean, compromise doesn't mean you give up your principles. It means you brush off the sharp edges. But there's not a willingness to listen. And it's a fancy word. There's a lack of empathy. And empathy simply means to feel, not as in touch, but to absorb. And once we can, I think it's the connective tissue in humankind now. And we've lost it
Valerie,
to a large degree.
Sorry for interrupting. Unfortunately, we only have a couple minutes, but I did want to get into this. You did not want your brother to run for president in 2020. Why not?
Because my expectation was that the former president would do everything in his power to try to destroy my brother and my family. And my expectations were exceeded, and he has not stopped. I said to Joe, "You've done it enough. You've served time." And my brother said, "I can't walk away because of fear." My brother, what I talk about in the book, was a young boy. He stuttered terribly. He knows what it means to be bullied. He knows what it means to be humiliated and told to shut up. And I viewed the former president as a bully.
You pull no punches in your sentiment regarding former President Trump.
Yes, he's a person I have little respect for.
As our country suffers through some dark times, Valerie, you believe good will prevail? Is that accurate?
Oh yes, yes, and we must. And you know, silence is complicity, which is a sentence I've heard my brother often say. And yes, good will prevail when good men and women, we have to stand up, step up to the plate, and say this is, we have to hold on to our democracy. Democracy just doesn't exist all by itself. We got to work for it. Again, my analogy is like a good marriage. You got to work for it every day. And that's what we have to do with our democracy. We cannot take it for granted.
What advice would you give anyone thinking about running for a political office for the first time, especially in this political climate?
I would. There are three things I would say. First of all, it's our responsibility to be engaged as citizens, but that sounds highfalutin. But when you decide to run, what would be to get your personal life in order? I'm not talking about CIA looking in your files and your garbage bags. I'm talking about your personal life with your spouse, your children, your partner, that you know that when you come home you have peace, because it's a lot of incoming when you walk outside the door. And the second thing is to know what you're willing to lose over.
Yeah.
You know, why are you, not what will you do to win, but what are you willing to lose over?
Got to leave it there, because unfortunately we are out of time. It was a pleasure to have you with us.
And
I do need to mention you're chair of the Biden Institute at the University of Delaware. The book is Growing Up Biden, a memoir. And Valerie, you will be at the Free Library of Philadelphia tomorrow at 7:30. Thanks again.
I shall. Bye-bye.
And take
care.
Bye. And stay with us as the regional roundup continues on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It's been a while since we've talked Philly sports, and there is a lot going on. The Phillies have come alive, but can they get to the playoffs without Bryce Harper? Also, Sixers acquire 24-year-old De'Anthony Melton. What does this mean for shooting guard Matisse Thybulle? World Cup soccer comes to Philadelphia in 2026, and the Flyers have a new head coach in John Tortorella, a man with the emotional intelligence of a chainsaw, according to Inquirer sports columnist Marcus Hayes, our guest for the remainder of the hour. Marcus joins us now via Skype. And hey, Marcus, how's it going?
It's going well, Mary. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So to the Phillies first. On Saturday, you wrote Bryce Harper should be the first designated hitter to win MVP, even though you actually hate the DH. Saturday night, Harper's left thumb is broken by a 97-mile-an-hour fastball. Marcus, Phillies are finally taking off under interim coach Rob Thomson. Does this jeopardize their chances at getting to the playoffs, despite their win of the series over the Padres the past few days?
Absolutely. Of course it does, but it doesn't ruin their chances. It doesn't mean they can't make it. They spent $179 million this offseason upgrading their lineup with a power left-handed hitter in Kyle Schwarber and a power right-handed hitter in Nick Castellanos. And I always believed that they did that with the understanding that, number one, Rhys Hoskins and Bryce Harper needed help in that lineup, and because JT Realmuto, the catcher, isn't quite the hitter they'd hoped he'd be. But also, number two, you have to have some insurance. If you're going to spend that kind of money on Bryce Harper, who's in for $33 million, and JT Realmuto, who's in for $115, you have to have some insurance. And they can make the playoffs if the insurance produces. And, you know, to their credit, since Bryce Harper's been hurt these two games, both Castellanos and Schwarber have produced.
There have been comparisons made of Thompson to Charlie Manuel. Do you see it?
Absolutely. One of the biggest issues in sports is when the coach's personality or ego is bigger than that of the clubhouse. And that's not necessarily something the manager or coach can do anything about, and it's not always bad. But when, you know, just to use the Phillies as an example, when you have a Larry Boa who's got a gigantic personality, a Ryan Sandberg, people forget his brief tenure, but Ryan Sandberg's a Hall of Fame baseball player. When you have a Joe Girardi with his pedigree, or a Gabe Kapler with his oddities and his soliloquies, you have to have a clubhouse who can handle them, and the Phillies haven't. Charlie and Rob are both guys with very small egos and very, very placid personalities, benign personalities. They really want you to do well, and it's never about them. So this is a better marriage than Joe Girardi and the Phillies. Rob Thompson and the Phillies, Charlie Manuel and the Phillies in that edition are better marriages for what the Phillies are and have.
So how do you see Thompson's future with this team, with this club?
You know, it's interesting. I want to say it was 2019. I was outside of the dugout talking to Larry Boa. I might have been in the clubhouse talking to Larry Boa, who's a special advisor for the team and has been for years. And we got to talking about Rob Thompson. And unsolicited, Larry Boa said, Rob Thompson's the best managerial candidate who's never gotten a chance to be a manager.
Huh, interesting.
So I believe that he is more than just a stopgap measure. And I believe he was on the staff to be more than just a stopgap measure. And a lot of people don't realize that, yes, while Rob Thompson was on Joe Girardi's staff with those great Yankee teams, Rob Thompson preceded Joe Girardi to Philadelphia. Joe Girardi spent a year in broadcasting. Rob Thompson was hired as Gabe Kapler's bench coach and survived the firing of Gabe Kapler.
So when did they make it official?
Probably at the end of the year. They'll see how things go. You know, you can't have guys like Harper, Schwarber, Castellanos, Real Muto on your roster and not have input from them about what happens day to day as far as preparation. We haven't had a prolonged losing streak. We don't know how Rob Thompson deals with that. You know, it's funny. We, you know, in Brett Brown or Gabe Kapler or Chip Kelly or Andy Reid, we forget that these guys, even though they've been in the game a long time, they're still rookie managers / coaches, and they're going to make mistakes. You don't know how they're going to react, no matter how well the team takes to them right away. You don't know how they're going to react in certain situations. So you let a season play itself out. And honestly, even if they, you know, of course, if they win the World Series, he can write his own ticket. But if they play well and stay in contention, I expect him to remain, but on a very, very, like, low-money, show-me kind of contract.
All right. So to the Sixers, headline on your column Thursday morning read, NBA draft, Sixers shouldn't sign P.J. Tucker, trade Matisse Thybulle, Tobias Harris. So the Sixers swung a deal in which they acquired guard D'Anthony Melton, and their first-round pick and Danny Green go to Memphis. What does Melton do for the Sixers?
He provides Daryl Morey a security blanket. Daryl Morey drafted Melton back in the 2018, or acquired him back in 2018.
He's got some history with
when he was with the Houston Rockets. Yeah, and the joke is he just wants to bring the Houston Rockets northeast to Philadelphia because James Harden is already here. And, you know, they will negotiate, or they will pursue P.J. Tucker when free agency begins at the end of the month. So, I mean, and D'Anthony Melton, you alluded to it in the beginning of the piece. You know, he's very, very similar to Matisse Thybulle, who might be best served as a sixth man. Now, you can argue that if Matisse Thybulle starts, he needs to have a viable backup. And maybe they see D'Anthony Melton, maybe they see him as a D'Anthony Melton as a viable backup to Matisse, who I think they'd still like. You know, he's not as good a 3-point shooter as they need him to be, right around 30%. But so was Jason Kidd the first 3 years of his career. You know, and I don't expect Matisse Thybulle to go into the Hall of Fame like Jason Kidd did, but you can become a better shooter.
But before this happened, you wrote Josh Harris, Doc Rivers, Daryl Morey must know they have in front of them the foundation for consistent contention. They just lack the fortitude to let it mature. And of course, you know, Harris, Rivers, Morey, that's owner, head coach, president, respectively. So now what? What does this team look like moving forward?
You know, I hope it doesn't look much different. I believe that this team could have beaten Miami in the second round of the playoffs had Joel Embiid been healthy. And they're a pretty good matchup for the Boston Celtics if the Boston Celtics don't shoot if the Boston Celtics don't shoot really well. That said, I'm not a big fan of remaking any team over and over and over again. And it just doesn't play well. The Golden State Warriors, the Milwaukee Bucks, the Miami Heat have been relatively cohesive, and they've allowed these teams to develop, even with older players on them. You know, there's value in familiarity. So hopefully they don't go out and get the big fix. I mean, the last time they did this, they went out and purported to play bully ball with Al Horford, and that was a disaster. But this is what we see over and over again, not necessarily with Daryl Morey, but with Josh Harris, the owner. The first thing he did was he traded 4 first-round draft picks for Andrew Bynum. Yeah. And 2 of those first-round draft picks that he traded have done very, very well. It's just foolish, I think, to build something and then scrap it literally, 30 games, 40 games in? Because James Harden's only been here for 30 or 40 games.
Yeah. World Cup soccer comes to the Link in 2026. Philly will be one of 11 cities in the U.S. hosting the tournament. Marcus Hayes, my husband and I saw Italy versus Ireland at the old Giants Stadium in 1994, the last time the World Cup was in the U.S., and it was insane. It was packed with these crazy, passionate fans from Europe, all of them, or I should say most of them, smoking cigarettes. You know, Ireland won, I think it was 1-0. Does Philly know what it's in for?
Oh, absolutely. Philadelphia is a very, I mean, one of the weird things about Philadelphia is this sort of, not underground, but underappreciated sort of, you know, weekend morning tradition where a lot of the bars will open so people can go wear their jerseys and watch Premier League games from Europe. So, yeah, Philly's got a very, very strong soccer sense. The Union is a very good team with an excellent following, with a wonderful coach in Jim Curtin. Yeah. So, yeah, Philly knows what's coming and will embrace it. I think it'll be a wonderful festival.
Well, you write that soccer hooligans make Eagles fans look like pussycats.
Well, that's the I don't think you're going to see a whole lot of hooliganism at the World Cup in Philadelphia, but they do. I mean, the difference between soccer hooligans and Philadelphia Eagles fans is there are a lot more hospital visits with soccer hooligans than Philadelphia Eagles fans, and they're very organized. You know, they're like gangs.
I didn't mean to imply that either. I just say it's just going to be really, really exciting. So, anyway.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It'll be fun.
Okay, so on to the Flyers, desperately in need of new leadership, as new head coach John Tortorella introduced himself recently. You said he might have been shoveling some manure. Marcus, care to explain?
Well, John's a very intense person with very, very concrete views, values, and ideals. And those views, values, and ideals, when they're not accepted, you know, out of hand, wholeheartedly by the team that he's coaching, you know, it's a painful adjustment. And to suggest that this won't be a painful adjustment, to suggest that, you know, John Tortorella suddenly has this, you know, emotional IQ like Doug Peterson or Charlie Emanuel is ridiculous. And he may try to enact that, and he tries to express that, but in the same conversation, he'll contradict that. You know, say, well, there's going to be some growing pains. There's going to be some conflict. You know, I have to do this. I have to do that. I have to do the other, which means we're going to get the same thing. Now, my contention in the column was, I don't know that the character of the team that as it's comprised right now can handle that. Okay. These are very fragile guys. These are underachieving, well-paid, sensitive hockey players in a very tough town with a very tough coach, which makes for great sports columns. You know, I'm going to enjoy the next couple of years, but I don't think the Flyers and the Flyers fans are going to enjoy it very much.
All right. So even with Torts, as he's called on board, you're not sure the talent's in place to make the Flyers a contender.
I don't think the talent or the character is there. You know, these guys aren't very tough. And you got to be tough to play in Philly. You got to be tough to be successful in hockey. And you certainly have to be tough to play for John Tortorella.
All right. Eagles training camp happens, at the end of next month? Marcus, you say it never makes sense to predict a season's outcome as soon as the schedule emerges. But that doesn't mean it isn't fun. So a couple quick predictions. Eagles meet the Commanders and Carson Wentz twice in the upcoming season. How's that go, in your opinion?
Just, I don't care. I'm just so happy it's going to happen. I mean, when they traded Carson Wentz when Carson Wentz landed in Washington, I was like, what have I done to deserve this blessing? Because it's going to be manic. It's going to be crazy. That said, Washington's a pretty good team. They're a horrible organization, but they're a pretty talented team, and they should give the Eagles a couple of good games, and it'll really depend on how the Eagles offensive line holds up. Washington's defensive line isn't quite as good as it has been, but both of those games will be decided in the trenches.
Doug Peterson's Jacksonville Jaguars, you know, after Eagles fans give Peterson a Philly-style welcome, probably not much happening with the Jaguars, right?
No, they're not a very they have a lot of issues, and God bless Doug. If he lasts 2 years there, it'll be a miracle. They just have made so many mistakes over the past 4 or 5 years, and Doug isn't the guy to come in and fix mistakes. Doug is actually a lot like Charlie Manuel and Rob Thompson. He's a good manager of people, but I don't know that he's a developer of young talent. As we saw with Carson Wentz, when Frank Reich went away, and Carson Wentz kind of stopped developing when it was left to Doug Peterson. So I don't mean to, you know, malign Doug Peterson. He's very good at some things, but developing young quarterbacks might not be the greatest of his gifts.
There's a chance the Birds could meet St. Nick Foles, when they take on the Colts. Foles is the backup there.
He is. Can you imagine the season if they get Carson Wentz twice, Doug Peterson once, and happen to play, you know, Nick Foles happens to play in that game?
Oh, it'll be so much fun.
Oh, my God. It's like free money for me. You know, I don't have to think. I don't have to create. I don't have to do anything. I just show up and let it play out.
All right. Well, let's get to professional golf. The Saudi-backed professional league LIV, inaugural event earlier this month in London. As it competes with the PGA Tour, LIV nabbed, among others, 52-year-old Phil Mickelson. But they needed some younger blood, and they got it, Marcus.
Yeah, that's the worst. That's the worst news for the PGA Tour. That, you know, a guy like Brooks Koepka is going, a guy like Bryson DeChambeau is going, which is awesome because I don't know if your listeners know, they despise each other. They haven't spoken in 2 years, and they actively antagonize each other, which is weird for golf. The more young players they can get, the better off they'll be. And they're getting some guys in their prime. I mean, Kevin Na is a very, very good golfer in his prime. Abram Answer is a very, very good golfer. He hasn't been out of the top 30 in 5 years. You don't, or four or 3 years. You don't hear a lot about him, but he's kind of the foundational player of the PGA Tour, a guy who can compete with guys like Rory McIlroy and Justin Thomas week in and week out and give them a run for their money.
You say the PGA Tour might not survive?
It might not. You know, I don't think the...
Hard to imagine.
Well, yeah, but the LIV Tour, I don't think it's interested in merging. I think the LIV Tour is interested in being the big boy in golf. And with a $600 billion, you know, backing and $2 billion earmarked especially for the LIV Tour, the money's endless. I mean, these guys are professional athletes. We can moralize all we like, and I think sports washing is horrible. But if you're in their situation and they can make more money by signing a paper, then they're likely to make. I'll give you an example.
We've got about 10 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay. The guy who won the first LIV event made more money in that day than he made in the last 4 years.
Wow. All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on it. Never a dull moment, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
Marcus Hayes, is always great to have you with us. Thanks so much. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you for having me.
Marcus Hayes is a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Just a reminder, you can find today's show at WHYY.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez is our engineer, our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for listening and be well.